A very warm welcome. You're listening to Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, talking through the stories they've been tackling this week. And today I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries, and on the agenda today, we've got a host of property issues, homeowners rushing to remortgage amid fears of a rate rise. But are there any super cheap deals left? What next for mortgage rates to track or to fix? And if so, for how long? The rise of buy-to-let, and how much higher can rents go?
Consumer price inflation has gone up by 38%, whereas the median private rent has gone up by 80%, an extra £30 a week that the average renter is paying on rent than they really should be.
And could the attraction of solar panels as an investment be killed off by proposed government cuts? Also today, the fallout from Black Monday continues. Billions wiped off the value of global companies over fears about the state of China's economy.
There is so little transparency around Chinese economic figures, and there is a degree of mistrust, frankly, across global markets.
Should investors sell up, sit tight, or even buy cheap shares? And is your pension in peril? We have a market mayhem survival guide coming up. If you're a regular Virgin train passenger, bad news, I'm afraid, in store for your bank balance. And what is Corbynomics?
It's a real black swan moment in British politics. If Corbyn is going to win the Labour leadership, then the question would be, what will he do? And I think he's going to make British politics interesting again.
And also, this is your 30-minute warning. Simon gets angry at Islington Council again.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. This is Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries from This Is Money. We're kicking off the show today all with a fair bit of property news. There's lots of it about today on the agenda. Is there any point of solar as an investment? With government plans to cut payments to homeowners, the rush to remortgage, what next for mortgage rates, banks luring potential buy-to-let pensioners, and the ever-rising cost of renting. But first, let's focus on the amount of cash paid to homeowners and businesses who produce electricity from rooftop solar panels and small wind turbines are set to be slashed almost 90% from next year. It doesn't stop there either. It's going to be lowered every year after that. And critics say the proposals would kill off the appetite for solar panels, as it would drive down a typical home's returns from £495 to just £64 per year. So, I mean, you've done quite a lot about this on This Is Money.
Yeah, we have. The thing to remember is that solar panels have been quite a nice little earner for people over recent years, especially if you got in early on these. Going back sort of 4 or 5 years ago, you got paid 42p a kilowatt for energy that you generated, and now you get paid just under 13p. Basically, the idea behind this was that this subsidy was to massively increase the amount of renewable energy that we created. It backfired slightly because there was a way that companies could pull this money in by putting solar panels on people's roof for free and then taking the money themselves. That led to this massive gold rush. And people will probably remember you basically got a lot of cold calling at the time saying, do you have a roof? Do you want some solar panels? We'll give them to you for free and you can save X amount. That was canned and the payments started to step down, but people still continued to put them on their roofs. And actually, because the cost of the panels has fallen dramatically to about £5,000 to £8,000, the return on them has remained pretty good. And if you just take the payments, then you would be getting, at the current cost of the panels, you'd be getting a return of 8.4% a year just in payments, or if you include the estimated energy bill savings, you get 10.4%. Government says no more, we can't afford it, we're going to take it down to almost zero.
Is that what the government's justification for this?
Well, they've just said it's just unsustainable, basically. They've argued that we've had this big boom in solar, and so it's achieved what it's meant to have achieved, and that this is not sustainable, and that if they don't make these cuts, then they might just have to completely stop generation payments. Now, what you would still get is a payment for exporting energy to the grid, and also the saving on your energy bill. But the big winner for having the solar panels is actually the generation payments. So at the moment, a house in London in the southeast of England, the Energy Saving Trust estimates £495 a year in generation tariff, £95 a year in export tariff, and electricity bill savings of £135. So that generation tariff is the bulk of it, as you mentioned earlier. And if that goes from £495 to £64 a year, it's basically just not going to be worth splashing out £7,000 on some solar panels.
Well, earlier I spoke to Hannah Maundrell, editor-in-chief of money.co.uk, about this.
It's potentially worthwhile, as it could still cut the amount you pay for electricity, but you really need to do the sums and work out if it's worth the cost. Up front, you can be talking thousands of pounds to install solar panels, and as you can't assume that you'll be able to earn anything back from the government for excess energy that you generate in the future, it all has to be reliant on the savings that you'll make. Now, the Energy Saving Trust say the average household could save around £120 a year with solar panels, and that would take around 10 years to break even.
Your views to that?
I do think that there are two questions here. Firstly, is this worth doing in order to massively increase the amount of renewable energy that we're generating? Some people would argue that yes, it is, and that there's no way you were going to manage to do that without this kind of subsidy, and it has worked. We have massively increased the amount of solar energy we're generating. On the other side of the coin, you've got people who say, well, look, this is basically giving money to the wealthy because we all pay for this through our energy bills, but the people benefiting from this are the kind of people who've got deep pockets and can afford to go out and spend £7,000 on solar panels. And they argue that that money would be better spent elsewhere rather than subsidising bumper returns for the rich. I think that it will happen. The government will do this. It's a consultation, so it's not definite, but it will happen, and it's pretty much killed off the idea of solar panels as an investment, unless the price of fitting solar panels drops by a lot again, i.e. it halves.
You've had some listener, or reader rather, comments on there that Annie was chuckling away at earlier.
This actually shows the divide on this issue. Winseer in Chatham says, if an investment needs a government subsidy to work, then I suggest it's not an investment at all, but rather a government benefit. Solar panels make nowhere near enough power to pay for themselves, let alone enough power to sell off. Null says they do, actually. 16 panels on a roof generates 2,000 kilowatts a year. That's half of what your average family uses, and so on. I've personally experienced this, is that my wife's dad's got solar panels on his roof, and he's delighted with them. He's one of those people, those early adopters, getting paid the 42p. Now, he paid much more for the panels than the panels cost now, but the return that he's getting on them, he says, is great, and he also likes the fact that he is generating his own electricity. Yeah. And actually, the real key, probably, to the future of solar is the ability to store that energy. And the problem at the moment is that you can't really do that. When the sun's shining, nobody's using any energy because they're out of work all day, and you need to be able to store it and use it in the evening when you come home.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on from solar panels, sticking though with the property theme, and now with interest rates tipped to go up sometime next year, don't worry, I won't ask you to predict when, homeowners have been rushing to fix their mortgages to take advantage of the low rates. Now, figures show the number of remortgaging approvals went up almost 30%. That's the largest increase in 4 years. As a result, we're seeing the best fixed rates inch up as banks look to squeeze a little more from borrowers. So where next for mortgage rates? Are there any cheap deals still left? Super cheap ones anyway. And if you find one, well, how long should you fix for? Lots of questions. Firstly, Tanya, give us a little bit of context. What does the landscape look like at the moment in terms of mortgage rates? Just how low they've been, sort of historically speaking?
Yes, they do remain low. I think that the fact that people are now expecting interest rates to stay low for longer means that more deals are available on the market. So there are still great deals out there, but people have to be very careful about what deal they choose, depending on their personal circumstances. Although you can look at the overall picture of how interest rates are going, a lot depends on your personal circumstances, how long you think you're going to stay in your property, how old you are as well, in terms of if you have a fix and you might want to move, you might want to downsize. In that situation, you can't be sure that you'll be allowed to take it with you. So there's lots of considerations. I think people need to make a very personal decision about it. But for the moment, anyway, the deals are still out there.
Well, you've been asking here how long to fix for. Someone's written in to This Is Money, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and you've actually asked the experts. What do they say?
Yeah, well, they again say it's down to your personal circumstances because interest rates really can only go up. Fix has been an incredibly popular bit of advice to people for a long time. But on the other hand, you don't want to get stuck in a deal for too long. I must admit that despite the advice that we constantly run on the site about fixing for longer, I actually only ever fix for 2 years. and I switch between trackers and fixes depending on where I think interest rates are going. And the reason I do that is I don't think that you can foresee what's going to happen to the economy more than 2 years ahead. I don't think you can even do it 2 years ahead. And I guess I just want to keep that a bit of control so that if things go really haywire, I can move. Obviously, fees are high, but I got around that last time by sticking with my current provider, so I didn't actually end up paying any fees.
But when you would have fixed for 2 years, the landscape would have been very different. I mean, of course, you wouldn't have known that we'd have had record interest rates as low as we have, but for the next 2 years hence, we're expecting rates to rise, are we not?
Well, I think I still would. I guess I'm a bit of a control freak. I like to be able to intervene every 2 years in what I've got. I went for a fix last time, but I think I probably did that too early. I thought that interest rates would start rising. I'd had trackers for a long time because they were cheaper and I couldn't see interest rates moving. So I thought it was a good calculated risk. But I think by the time they do actually raise interest rates, I would have probably been better off getting a tracker over those 2 years.
Interesting. You went for tracker, didn't you? But you've actually asked that question, to fix or to track, as it were, in your article, Simon. What next for mortgage rates?
Yeah, I've got a tracker mortgage. I've had a tracker mortgage for the last 5 years. It was a lifetime tracker mortgage, so there's no early repayment charges. I could leave when I could jump ship whenever I needed to if I thought interest rates were going to go up. And I fully expected to basically have to jump ship off that mortgage about 2 years in. And the reason why we took it was, A, because I didn't think interest rates were going anywhere at the time, but also, B, because there was a lot of benefits in terms of it was fee-free, but we got a free valuation, we got free legals, we got a load of stuff bundled in that was worth over £1,000. So it looked like a good deal. But if I was looking at it now, then I would probably fix. So why haven't I fixed? Well, I haven't fixed because actually I think I'll probably move in 2 years' time. But I have considered moving to a two-year fixed rate just for those next 2 years. The problem is actually I might need to move slightly earlier than 2 years' time, so it might not work. But the thing you need to watch out for is early repayment charges. Basically, the money that you save on your mortgage rate will almost certainly be wiped out by early repayment charges if you basically have to cancel your mortgage before the end of the deal period and take out another one, because early repayment charges run into thousands of pounds. But up against that, you've got this whole thing of mortgages being portable. You can theoretically take your mortgage with you. But that's up to the lender. The lender might decide, well, no, actually, we don't like the property that you're buying. You might need to borrow more money. So how are you going to borrow more money on it? And these are all the things that people need to think about. And that's what these three brokers said to us when we asked them the question. The one thing I would say, though, is a lot of people think, oh, they buy a house and they go, first-time buyers, you know, it's a classic one, well, we might move in 2 years' time, so I'll go for a two-year fix. And brokers do encourage this two-year fix thing. And the reason why they encourage that is because they make more money off people fixing for only 2 years and then remortgaging every 2 years. But most people don't move after 2 years. In fact, actually, they tend to move after 5 or 6. So it does pay to sort of weigh up your personal circumstances and think, would I really move in 2 years? But then also, like, say if you're a first-time buyer, you've just got married, and you think that you might have kids in 2 years' time, and you've only got one bedroom, well, then maybe you will be moving in 2 or 3 years' time. But if you're a first-time buyer and you're a young couple and you're not intending on getting married for ages and you don't want kids or something like that, or you've bought somewhere that's got 2 or 3 bedrooms that you know is going to be big enough for you for the next 5 or 6 years, then maybe you should look at a 5-year fix.
Well, that's the point. If you are one of those people in the middle, where should you err?
3. No, you can. Everybody talks about 2 or 5, but you can fix for 3 or 4 years as well. And actually, 4-year fixes are really quite good value. They're actually cheaper than 5-year fixes.
Well, there you go. So we are seeing this big increase in remortgaging because of what I said, these murmurings about interest rate rises. For anyone that doesn't know, why does it make such a difference?
Why does it make such a difference? Because it affects the cost of funding to banks for the money that they lend out as mortgages. And it's not quite as direct as that, because it's not like they take the money in and then directly lend out every single pound that they take in. When you take out a mortgage, they basically create the money on a computer. But they have to hold some money against that. And the path of interest rates in the future affects how much it costs them to get money in. Be that from the money markets or be that from savers. So if there is an expectation that interest rates will be rising in the near future, then the cost of banks getting that money is more expensive. So then they ask for more money off you because they add their margin to the top of it, and then they charge you your mortgage rate. Now, there's some other things that come into play there. A, how big a margin is the bank operating on? And at the moment, banks and building societies have got pretty decent margins that they're operating on, and also how much competition is there in the market. Go back 4 years ago, banks and building societies were not particularly interested in lending out mortgages. They were very, very price sensitive to any suggestion of a move in interest rates. Now, they are quite keen to lend out mortgages and they want to be making money. So actually, there's more competition in the market. So you could find a situation where rates rise and mortgage rates don't move up that much because they absorb a little bit of it.
But you do say some of the absolute cheapest mortgage rates have been pulled as banks look to squeeze a little more from borrowers.
Yeah.
But rates, as you point out, remain historically low.
But you're looking at, so if you've taken out a mortgage of £200,000 and it's the difference between there used to be a 1.05% rate and there's now a 1.07% rate,
yeah,
you're talking about pounds on your monthly bill. So the mortgages are still cheap. They're not quite as cheap.
Where can we look for some good deals?
Well, the best thing to do is to go to our What Next for Mortgage Rates roundup. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage rates, and there you will find our guide to how you can choose whether to fix or track, what the best buys are, the place where we put forward all the information so people can try and make the best informed decision that they can.
Fantastic. Now, if you can't afford to buy a home, let alone remortgage the one you already have, then you won't be cheered by the news of a return of rapid rent rises as tenants' bills soar to record highs. According to figures from the estate agents Your Move and Reeds Rains, July saw the biggest monthly jump in rental costs since their records began back in 2009, taking the average rent in England and Wales to above £800. Now, Dan Wilson-Craw is from Generation Rent, which campaigns for the right of renters. He spoke to us a little earlier.
For years and years, we've seen a shortage of new homes being built, and that's just piling up excess demand in the market. And it's clearly spreading around the country. It's not just a London issue. The cities are around the whole country that are seeing huge increases in rent. I know someone who moved to Manchester to escape the costs of London, and his rent's going up this year. So it's a problem that's spreading. We actually did some research which found that over the past 15 years, consumer price inflation has gone up by 38%, whereas the median private rent measured by a government survey has gone up by 80%. That actually works out at an extra £30 a week that the average renter is paying on rent than they really should be if rent had gone up at the same rate that everything else has gone up.
So, Tanya, what do you make of Dan's views from Generation Rent there? Consumer price inflation over the last 15 years gone up 38%, 80% rise in private rental prices for the same period.
I think it's extremely worrying, and the kind of young people stuck in rented accommodation are the kind of people who have a lot of other pressures on them at the moment. They've got student debt, the employment market isn't that great for them as well. And it's I think, a symptom of the wider problem that we've got with housing, which is under supply. We need to build more homes. I know that some people do think it's because part of the problem with the housing market is because of cheap credit. But there's such pressures in the rental market as well that can't be down to the ease of getting mortgages. Mm. The people who are trying to rent are having horrendous problems too.
Especially in London, renting 60% more expensive than the national average. Where else, according to your article, are we seeing rents rise the most as well?
Rents are going up the fastest in London. That's the annual change. The east of England, they're up 12%. And then once you look beyond that, you've got the south east, they're up a lot. The West Midlands, they're up a lot. But what's happening here, right, OK, is that this is not across the board. What's happening here is you've got hotspots, and that's what drives this. And London is the classic hotspot. Why have rents gone up so much in London? Well, because basically there is a constraint on the amount of places that there are for people to live. But basically because pretty much a lot of the country and a lot of Europe have decided to try to move to London post the financial crisis because they've seen it as a place where they can get a better opportunity to get on. So there's been a huge pressure on London over recent years, and that's why rents have gone up so much. And renting in London is a pretty miserable experience, I think, for most people. Then now you're seeing places like Manchester and stuff like that, where there has been this trend observed where people are going, I'm not going to move to London anymore because it is too expensive. Mm-hmm. Where am I going to go next? I'm going to go to Manchester, or I'm going to go to Birmingham. And so that's why you're seeing rents rise there. You've got Leeds as well, which is on the up again after having suffered post-financial crisis. But go outside of those major cities, you know, go out into the surrounding towns or surrounding villages, and I would suggest that you probably wouldn't see that rental price inflation to anywhere near that extent. So should people be moving into the surrounding towns and cities? The thing is, that's not where they want to live, is it?
Well, you might want to as well, but if you're on the Virgin train line, you might be in for a little bit of a sting. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. But final question on this, Dan Wilson-Craw from Generation Rent talking there about the idea of a rent cap. Now, like Labour leadership candidate Jeremy Corbyn, also a fan of that. What exactly would that entail? And good idea, could it practically work?
It would be very difficult because it would skew the market. But you could argue that we haven't got a free market in housing as it is. So how much worse could more meddling do? It's very difficult to know exactly how it would work. They do some kind of rent control in New York, for instance. But then that causes all sorts of other problems, like people sublet, and then they make loads of money off the sublet. It does skew the market. So you have to tread really carefully with how you actually do it in practice. I can't see how exactly they would do it successfully at the moment.
Also, if you set a rent cap at, say, inflation or inflation plus a small amount, what will happen is basically everybody will put rents up by inflation or inflation plus a small amount. And I ran some figures on this when Ed Miliband suggested it as part of his ploy to be the next Prime Minister. Yep. Actually, if you looked back over the recent past, you found that actually rents had been rising by less than inflation. And had you, I can't remember what the exact time period was, but basically if rents had risen with the suggested cap, it would have been more expensive to rent, so it would have backfired. So as Tanya said, once you start intervening in markets like that, you're playing with fire, really.
It's the unintended consequences, isn't it? So does all this mean that it's a sweet time if you're a landlord? Are they just coining it in at the minute?
Well, I guess they are. And the trouble is that there's so much interest in it. We get so many hits from buy-to-let stories because people really want to invest in it. But the trouble is that the more people buy them as investment properties, the fewer properties there are for people who just want to live in a property, buy a property and live in it. And that is going to cause a problem down the line.
Although buy-to-let was created as a concept in order to expand the supply of rental property. So if you're saying that rents are going up too quickly because there's not enough homes to rent, then do you want more buy-to-let landlords? I don't know.
Well, we might be getting them. Research from Moneyfacts, let's talk about buy-to-let now for a little bit, shows buy-to-let mortgage deals have hit a seven-year high. Now, they're reaching over 1,000 for the first time since 2008. Not only that, but rates are at their lowest level for years, around 3.8%. Now, that's a drop from 7.34% rate that we saw in August 2008. Earlier, I spoke to Rachel Springall from moneyfacts.co.uk, who says new pension freedoms may have played a part.
It's so easy now for people to take out that money and they can then invest it into something they see as a profitable return, which is a property. Now, property at the moment, if people are looking at the rents are so high, property prices are fairly reasonable for, you know, if people, if they have that deposit to put down, the interest rates on the mortgage or the loan is really low. So they're seeing it as a win-win situation. I mean, a lot of people are using property as their retirement fund because they're getting something every month and, you know, they're seeing that as something that they can have for the long term.
Tanya, you're the pensions expert. Is that about right?
Well, yes, I think people are using their pension pots to buy buy-to-let property. The trouble is that if you take out a really big chunk from your pension pot, then you are going to pay a lot of extra tax on it. And it's not clear whether the people who are doing it at the moment have actually realised that yet. It may be that they just haven't had their tax bills yet, because we haven't actually had any complaints in from people who have had shock tax bills, not yet. But there is a possibility that they're well aware of that and they're just willing to take the hit because they think buy-to-let is such a great investment that they're willing to do it anyway.
I read something the other day and I can't remember who it was who said it. It was someone from a pension company who said, we are actually warning people about this tax situation and that they would face, some of them would face 40% tax. And actually we're finding that they're just taking the money out anyway. So they're just going, oh, I don't care, I want the money. So maybe they feel buy-to-let is so much more of a compelling investment, something that they can control themselves, that they're just like, fine, take the tax.
Well, that's a good point. Why do you think that's the case? Why are people ignoring this sort of advice to go for buy-to-let?
People trust bricks and mortar. They think bricks and mortar is safer than the stock market, which, you know, they've seen the stock market swing around wildly over the past
week. We'll get onto that in a minute.
And more of them will have gone, well, I'm putting my money in bricks and mortar. I know what I like and I like what I know. In terms of what's going to change, for landlords who've got big mortgages, so who basically are borrowing at sort of the upper end of what you'll lend on buy-to-let, which is 75% loan-to-value, so they put down a 25% deposit, many of them won't actually be making that much money in profit. And there is, at the moment, a system whereby you can offset your mortgage interest against the income tax that you would pay on the rent. And George Osborne decided that he wasn't going to allow all of this anymore. it's been a bone of contention for some time. It's going to be cut down to the basic rate of tax relief in 2020. And for those landlords who are not making a particularly large amount in rent, their yields are quite low, they might have quite big mortgages, that could seriously dent their profits. And there's a suggestion that actually some of them will basically start losing money. The principle behind this is you only pay tax on your profit. So your mortgage interest, you take that off the rental income, that leaves your profit, and you pay tax on that profit. Now, what you're going to be doing now is you get your rental income, you get taxed on that, and then you get a smaller break back for the mortgage interest. So you're actually going to be taxed on your revenue. Now, there is an argument against this from people who say, well, but if I borrowed money to invest in shares, I wouldn't be able to offset that against my tax. But then that does miss the point that the whole concept of buy-to-let was built up that you did borrow money to invest in property, and that you don't borrow money to invest in shares unless you are a Chinese stock market gambler who has learned a valuable lesson over the past week.
Indeed. One final one on this before we do talk a bit more about China, but your journalist Mark Shoffman looking at, is it worth moving your buy-to-let into a company in order to keep the mortgage interest relief? What was his conclusion there?
Maybe.
Right, great. Moving on.
So look, there's been this suggestion that people will do this to dodge it. Because if it's a company, you can still offset your debt costs, your mortgage. But actually, for someone who's got one property or two properties, this just isn't really going to be worth doing. Those who've got a big portfolio of properties will probably find that it is. Because actually, there is something that you'd have to pay corporation tax. Then if you wanted to access the money, you would have to take it out in some way. So you may have to pay dividend tax on that if you pay it to yourself as a dividend. And dividend tax is changing, going to go up. But also, actually, the process of moving the property into the company crystallises a capital gain. So you'd have a capital gains tax liability on what you've made in terms of profit since when you bought that property. And also you'd have to pay stamp duty, even though you're transferring it to yourself. You're transferring it from you to this company, and so there'll be a stamp duty cost as well to the company. So actually, probably won't work out to be a good idea for people who've only got one or two properties.
Editor Simon Lambert, also in studio journalist Tanya Jeffries from This Is Money.
Morning Money. The markets, the papers and the city. Today's Need to Know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website. So far, we've looked at a host of property issues. Homeowners rushing to remortgage. Super cheap deals. Are there any left? What next for mortgage rates to track or to fix? The rise of buy-to-let and how much higher can rent prices go? But let's turn our attention abroad and to troubles in the markets. It's been called Black Monday, one of the bleakest times in recent histories for the stock market, as early this week we saw billions of pounds wiped off the value of shares around the world because of fears about China's economy as investors panicked, sold their shares. In the UK, the FTSE 100 plunged nearly 5%, while America's main index dropped 3.5%. Well, Stephen Guilfoyle is a trader in the US.
China is that engine behind global demand. So now that we don't really know how fast the Chinese economy is growing, or even if it is growing, we're in a situation where we have to price in a lot of uncertainty.
But even though world markets have perked up, fears remain over China's economy, with analysts saying the volatility isn't over yet. So should investors sell up, sit tight, or even buy cheap shares? And is your pension in peril? Thankfully, This Is Money team have an opinion on this. So Simon, firstly, your reaction to Black Monday.
Black Monday. Wow, it's like the good old days of the financial crisis. It's like, whoa, what's happening now? It's like
Was it like that though?
It was. Look, at one point the market was down like 5.6%, something like that. We thought we were going to make it into the top 10 biggest falls, and in the end it wasn't down by that much. But it was swinging around quite wildly. There were moments when it was like, buy, sell. You know, we're not actually buying and selling, we were just joking as to whether it was rising or falling. But you know, there is this point where you watch the market in free fall And it is a funny thing to see. And
what
you think,
tipped
how long?
Because this has been rumbling for some time. What tipped that point where everything just went bananas?
China's Black Monday. Well, overnight, basically, shares in Asia, so they're traded overnight, obviously, compared to the Western world. And they dropped 8.5%. And everyone just sat up, took notice, and went, whoa. It's been rumbling on for a couple of months. The Chinese have tried to sort of solve the problem. And basically, the world decided that China had lost. A world that thought that maybe China could manage to control its stock market decided that China had lost control of its stock market. The market fell by a huge amount. Chinese investors, a lot of them, they don't make up a huge number of the population, but there are quite a lot of private investors, and a lot of them are doing it with borrowed money. So if markets go down and their positions get wiped out, they've suddenly got to find money to deal with the debts they've incurred from that. So they start selling other shares in order to deal with that. If you look at the Chinese stock market over the past year, this, especially the mainland China stock market, it's been as if somebody took two stories from the past and decided to write one story. So you've taken the 1920s US stock market bubble that was driven by everybody and their wife gambling on the stock market on borrowed money, and the dot-com boom, where any company that had the word dot-com put at the end of its name shot up in value. Put those two into a story, it was going to end in tears at some point.
We've seen a slight recovery, have we not?
Not necessarily
China, but everywhere else.
Well, it fell again the day after Black Monday. But it hasn't.
It
then rose again. The markets in the West have been a bit more choppy.
FTSE.
Closer to home. FTSE's been up and down. It's been up the last couple of days. There was this big moment when the US market, the Dow on Black Monday, opened and subsequently fell 1,000 points, which is, you know, a huge amount, but then managed to regain a load of ground. Now, what would have happened if it had fallen that 1,000 points and then, you know, stayed down or kept falling? Well, that could have been, that's anyone's, you know, prediction to make, but I think that that could have been this suggestion of, whoa, we're about to see another 20-30% correction. So the question now really that investors are asking themselves are, have we seen the worst of it? Have we seen the sort of 10%-ish correction that just happens in the stock market every so often? Or is this the start of a big one, a 20, 30, 40% drop over a longer period of time?
Is it? Answer.
Well, I don't know. If I knew that. No,
millionaire.
I tell you what, I would say one thing. My sister emailed me this week. She got an alert from her pension fund, which, if I was the pension company, I wouldn't send out alerts like this. But they sent out an email listing all her funds and how much they were down by over slightly random but very short-term periods of time of about a month. And a lot of them were down like 5 or 6%. And she said, what should I do? Do you think I should move my money? She said, I'd take it out. And I said to her, look, you're not investing for the past 6 months. You're investing for the next 35 years. That's what you need to think about. She's got a very long investment time horizon. If you're the kind of person who has a very short investment time horizon and you've got your money in risky assets that can fall by that much, then you need to reconsider what you're doing. But if you're the kind of person who's got a long investment time horizon, then yeah, it's much better if you manage to dodge the bullet of a 20, 30% fall. But most people just can't do that kind of market timing. Sod's Law says basically you'll get out and then the market will go up by 10%.
Tanya is the expert there. And I asked earlier, is your pension in peril?
Well, the thing is, when the markets are really low, you carry on contributing to your pension every month. So you're buying at the moment when the shares are really low. So you're actually buying cheap. You might have lost something on what you've got already. But with every new contribution you're putting in at this stage, you're getting to buy cheap. So like Simon says, over the course of your working life, you'll probably make that up. And actually some periods where it's low and you can buy cheap will work out for you.
And it's like you say, it's in it for the long term, which on your This Is Money website, you spoke to what seems the eminently sensible, one might say borderline, quite dull, boring, in his own admission here, a somewhat understated boss of Hargreaves Lansdown. I don't think he'll complain about that. Ian Gorham, who says, now is the perfect time to buy. Cover your ears. He says, ignore the short-term noise and see this as an opportunity to start to top up rather than to sell down.
And many of our readers would suggest that he would say that because he runs an investment platform and an investment firm. So it's obviously in his best interest if people do buy more because they end up with more assets under management. But no, actually, if you read James Salmon's interview with Ian Gorham, he makes a number of eminently sensible points in which he basically says, don't panic. Because actually, there are many studies that show whilst private investors don't ever get the same returns that their funds do. The funds that they are invested in do better than the investors who are actually invested in them because the fund's performance is tracked over a period of time, but the investors aren't in it for that period of time, what they tend to do is basically buy and sell at the wrong point. So they buy when the market's really high and they panic and sell when the market's really low. So they actually underperform the funds that they're invested in. And that is pretty much what Ian Gorham is saying.
Well, there you go. Let's leave that to one side now. And a lot has been written about Labour leadership candidate Jeremy Corbyn, from criticisms of NATO over its stance with Russia, threatening to break up Rupert Murdoch's media empire, calling Hamas friends, and to the latest, female-only carriages on trains. But what about his views on the economy? Well, he has a fair few, indeed a whole movement, it would seem, and it's been coined, yes, Corbynomics by the press. But what exactly is it? Is it just old ideas getting a fresh airing or something more innovative than that? Firstly, here's Tim Evans, Professor of Business and Political Economy at Middlesex University, who we spoke to a little bit earlier.
It's a real black swan moment in British politics, if you want to put it philosophically in Popperian terms. If Corbyn is going to win the Labour leadership, if that happens, then the question would be, what will he do? And I think he's going to make British politics interesting again.
If. I think that's quite important, but we'll put if to one side. Corbynomics, and you've got an article on This Is Money all about what is Corbynomics. A lot in there. Let's be honest, sounds a little bit sort of standard Labour and renationalisation, tackling tax dodgers, squeezing big companies up the workers, down Murdoch. Also emphasis on growth, not austerity. Perhaps the standout one of the ideas, got a lot of the press talking, is the people's quantitative easing. But before we get onto that, tell us a bit more about Corbynomics. Can we call it a movement as such, Corbynomics?
Yeah, I think it's a movement. It's a movement that's attracted a sizable number of people in sort of Labour's natural voting base who basically think Corbyn is the messiah. And then there's another chunk of the Labour Party who say he's not the messiah, he's a very naughty boy.
very good.
But he is putting forward a plan that is radically different to the one that the Labour Party has been putting forward for the past, back to Blair, 20 years nearly.
Which points are they radically different?
Okay, well, so basically what he's saying is that austerity is a mistake, that they would borrow to invest rather than just saying we need to pay down the debt. He is talking about renationalising the railways. Don't remember the Labour Party suggesting that recently. Potentially some of his supporters are talking about renationalising some other stuff rather than privatising it. And basically what he's saying is we need to have a fairer and more, you know, sort of redistributive society. And he's also come up with this idea of the people's QE. And if you take them separately, a lot of these things make sense. But also there's an element where it's a bit of populism. The document where he's laid out this plan doesn't read like the document of someone who thought he was going to find himself in this position. It reads like the document of someone who's putting forward some suggestions, which, fair enough, you know, he's standing for leadership. He's not standing for election. But what this has turned into is a massive Punch and Judy show, both on the left and on the right, where you've got, you know, the Labour Party bashing itself, you've got the right bashing the Labour Party. And what we thought would be interesting is to basically take a look at Corbynomics and say, well, what is this? And could it work? So Tanya dived in and did the job.
Tanya, could it work? Also, before you do that, what is people's QE that Simon just mentioned there?
Well, the QE that we've had so far has been creating money and buying bonds with it and putting it in the banks, which have then used it to go out and buy other stuff, usually driving up asset prices, with the hope that this will instill more confidence generally. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of an indirect way of going about it. What Corbyn is suggesting is that you use QE to boost public projects. You spend it on roads and hospitals and schools and worthy public works.
How is he going to do that realistically? Because the Bank of England's independent, so they couldn't get involved in that. That would have to be through government vehicles.
Well, he's talking about setting up a national investment bank, which would issue bonds that the Bank of England would then buy. But you raise a really good point. The Bank of England is independent and it wouldn't necessarily go along with this unless there was another emergency situation. Now, as far as I know, Corbyn hasn't actually specified when he thinks we should use people's QE. You know, the important aspect of this is that it was an emergency measure. And if you use it in normal times, then you really seriously risk inflation.
Just to add to that, actually, when we were publishing this, I asked Richard Murphy, who is Corbyn's essentially economic advisor, about people's QE, and I said, would it only be used in a crisis? And he said, no, not only in a crisis, but it wouldn't be needed if the economy was chugging along nicely and doing what it should do, which he said it isn't doing at the moment.
So, Tanya, could it work in practice in some
It's difficult to know, and a lot would depend, I guess, on what they actually spent it on and whether the public projects that they put it in had a kind of multiplier effect where it wasn't just the investment, but it actually created more jobs more widely and spread out. But you'd have to really kind of rely on them to pick the right projects and manage them competently without waste. And that's a pretty tall order.
So I actually suggested something similar way back in 2012 when we were talking about doing more QE. I said, if we are going to do more QE, let's just spend it on something useful, which is ultimately a bit like people's QE. But that was an emergency time when they were suggesting that we might need it. And the suggestion was, actually, let's just do this as a one-off emergency measure. I think the problem with the Corbynomics suggestion is that actually, maybe it would be better to be borrowing to invest. And the argument is that at the moment we can borrow at a very cheap rate and we should be borrowing to invest money. And if you are a supporter of people like Corbyn or the economist Paul Krugman, then you would say that that is a good idea. We should be borrowing more money to invest. If you are on the other side and you believe in what's called the Austrian School of Economics, you'd say no. Basically, the sickness in our economy is down to having too much debt, and we need to try and get rid of that debt, and we need to allow creative destruction. But the difficulty is with saying, well, we're going to borrow money when money's cheap to invest, is that involves ring fencing, and governments hate ring fencing. So it wouldn't just be, oh, we're borrowing this money to spend on roads and railways and schools and hospitals. It would be, we're borrowing this money to spend, and they don't like to ring fence pots of money. So maybe we should be trying to ring fence pot of money and doing it, but governments hate that kind of thing.
Now, Simon, take a wee breather. Everybody else, you've got your 5-minute warning. Simon getting on his soapbox to talk about Islington Council again. But before we do that, we're going to talk not about parking, but about trains. And if you're a regular Virgin train passenger, well, I'm afraid bad news in store for your bank balance. The train company's to scrap their off-peak fares for rail card holders who use services at peak times. It'll also see the cost of a return to London from cities such as Birmingham, Manchester, more than double for some. So if you've got a young person, 16 to 25, rail card, now they're expected to be hardest hit by the changes. It will also affect those with disabled and senior rail cards. Tell us a bit more about this, Tanya.
Well, Virgin is the only company that's been offering this kind of off-peak deal, and it's obviously decided that it's not going to do it anymore. It's got the right to do that, I guess. It fits in with its business model, and it thinks it can get away with it, which it probably can, because there's a lot of demand for rail tickets. The trouble is that having offered it, a lot of people have taken advantage of it. And because of the wider problems, I would argue, with the housing crisis and so on, the fact that people are willing to live in Birmingham and commute to London, in effect, or Manchester, they've taken advantage of this particular deal, and they've built their life around it. They've taken jobs in London. These people, on very short notice, are going to be very severely inconvenienced. They're probably going to have to lose their jobs because the rise is so huge for them.
Well, you focus on Hannah Young, who travels from Birmingham to London. Now, she did that in order to dodge the high cost of living in the capital, unsurprisingly, as we were talking about earlier. Now, she's going to see the same journey to work that previously cost £34.15 will cost £110.90 a day, which is extraordinary. Now, she's taken to Twitter to contact Sir Richard Branson directly. Any joy there? Has Sir Richard got back to her with an answer?
As far as we know, not yet.
Okay, well, Sir Richard, if you're listening, go back to Hannah and let her know.
He listens every week to this show.
I don't doubt Simon.
He does, he told me.
Oh, well, there you go then. Does Islington Council then?
No, they don't listen to anything.
Well, let's see what we can do about that, shall we? In the studio with us, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries. Now for our final story today, I did issue that warning. Simon brought with him his soapbox, so get it out if you would, Simon, to vent about an issue that makes his blood boil, and all began with a letter from Islington Council. And your wife, Simon, exclaiming, "Simon, you're not going to like this. Perhaps if best if you don't read it yet." I'm not sure what Mrs. Lambert sounds like, but was that sort of in the right vein there?
Yeah, broadly similar.
Yeah,
possibly more instructional.
Perhaps it's best if you don't read it yet. We're talking parking wars. So, Simon, you've got 2 minutes. Floor is yours. Go for it. What's the problem this time?
I have parking restrictions outside my house. Controlled parking zone from 8:30 to 6:30. 6 days a week, as do other parts of Islington. But some parts have it from 8:30 to 6:30 in the weekdays and 8:30 to 1:30. But now Islington has decided that there is a problem caused by the Arsenal Stadium matches being on. And so it's going to massively extend parking restrictions to 8:30 to 9 o'clock for a vast swathe of the borough, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Now, the only issue with this is that as part of the existing parking restrictions, there are already an extra bit that means that you can't park when there are football matches on or events at the Emirates Stadium. So basically, what it's done is invent a problem in order to come up with a solution. Now, the leader of Islington Council had the misfortune to end up on my doorstep the other day. He was canvassing. He's the Labour leader. He was canvassing. And he rang the bell for someone else in our building who'd recently signed up to the Labour Party. And I opened the door. And then he said, as he was going off, he said, "Oh, I'm your Labour councillor, by the way." And I was like, "Ah, yes, you are." I was like, "What about this parking thing?" And engaged this poor man on it. And he said, "Well, the problem is that the current parking restrictions, they're not fit for purpose." And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, because they don't cover the evenings when there's matches on." I said, yes, they do. And so I marched this poor man to the parking side on the street and pointed to him and said, "Look, they do." To which he did concede that they did. So I said, "Look, you've invented a problem to come up with a solution. People don't want this." And he was like, "Oh, well, we do." The problem is Islington's consultation. They haven't put forward any evidence in the consultation as to why this is needed beyond a problem they invented. And if you talk to local businesses, they say parking is the big issue, the shops, the restaurants. There's quite a few restaurants on the road near where I live. People do drive there. And the problem is if you look down Islington's reasons for doing this, you've got number one and two, which are already covered off by the existing restrictions, and number three, which is basically to cut down on car use. And what this is Islington has an ideological objection to the motor car, and it's decided to use the CPZ to crack down on it. And I don't think that councils should be making those decisions. So, Islington, I hope that you lose your consultation, and I hope you don't bring in these parking restrictions, because you are wrong.
And to Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries, thank you so much for joining us.
Share Radio.